Hey there, folks. This is Screen Watching. My name's Dan Barrett, joined by Simon Foster. This is the show where we do reviews and we talk about the big issues facing TV, streaming, movies, whatever happens on your screens. We're here to discuss it. On the show this week, we are going to solve the biggest problem facing the world of multimedia, let's say. We're going to fix Marvel. We're going to look at Marvel. We're going to break it down. We're going to tell you what's wrong with it and how to fix that thing right back up again and back on the road and get that jalopy jalopying its way down the motorway. We're going to do that. We've got some reviews. I, Dan Barrett, I'm going to take a look at NCIS. I'm going to try to answer the question, what even are the NCIS, a small branch of American law enforcement, doing with a Sydney branch? It makes no sense. I'm going to do that. And then I'm going to take a look at the brand new extension to what they call the Dussinverse, a name that I will not be embracing. This is the latest spin-off series from Yellowstone. It's called Lawman Bass Reeves. I'm going to talk about that. Simon, you're doing some movies, right? What are you talking about?
Good morning, Dan Barrett. Good morning, everyone listening to this, even if it's the evening. I am talking about a little film that's turned up on the Apple TV platform called Fingernail, starring one of my favorites, Jesse Buckley. And then because I gave it no airtime last week and the kids are really digging it, I'm going to have a look at Five Nights at Freddy's, the blockbuster video game adaptation, which is sweeping the world by storm. It's this year's Barbie, some are saying.
I feel that this year's Barbie was Oppenheimer, but, you know, we'll discuss that later. Folks, this is Screen Watching. We'll be back right after we do some opening credits.
This is not like TV, only better.
Television! Teacher! Mother!
Secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Look, Simon, I'm excited you're talking about Five Nights at Freddy's. I think Simon Foster, finger on the pulse. Why talk about it before people go to see it? Why not just talk about it after everybody's seen it?
Well, I didn't think anybody was going to see it. Then all of a sudden it opens to $80 million in the US. And 3 days of me walking around George Street looking after Monster Fest, I had to watch all these kids go and see another horror film that wasn't part of my Monster Fest. So it has become a pop culture phenomenon all over again. I guess you played the game back in your gamer days. I never did. I didn't even know it was a gamer, but we'll talk about all this in my review, no doubt. Can I just mention very quickly? On our Facebook page, you can win tickets to see a delightful new film called Uproar. It stars Julian Dennison from the little kid from Hunt for the Wilder People and the lovely Minnie Driver. You have to finish the sentence, "Uproar is the best thing to come out of New Zealand since," and you go to the screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com email address to answer that question. We've had three answers so far, and I just want to point out where our listeners' heads are at the moment. So the best thing to come out of New Zealand since, disposable syringes, Dave Dobbin's Slice of Heaven, and Melanie Bracewell. So our people are on the pulse and clearly all over New Zealand society. So go to our Facebook page to enter that contest.
Well, look, I was going to ask if I'm eligible to enter, but somebody's already said the Dave Dobbin's joke, so I'm just going to not bother at this point. Yeah, Simon, this leads us to the exciting part of the podcast. It's the reviews.
It stinks.
The biggest TV program that is going to debut from this fine country, it's a TV show called NCIS Sydney.
What was once the far side of the world is now the most contested patch of water on the planet. Our two nations,
NCIS,
AFP, Australian Federal Police,
you stand shoulder to shoulder.
This is our turf.
We can have a problem here.
To ensure this vast swathe of ocean remains peaceful for generations to come.
It will not surprise you, Simon, to know that in the opening moments of NCIS Sydney, you not only see the Sydney Harbour, you see the Sydney Harbour Bridge, and then in that same shot, the camera swings down past a little thing called the Opera House. You get to see that in like the first 10 seconds, and then if you asked me, like before I'd seen the program, if you just said, Dan, NCIS Sydney, what's the opening shot? I would tell you, camera pans through the harbour, lands at the local military base where you will see some sort of a politician standing at a podium addressing sailors. And that is absolutely how the program opens.
It almost writes itself, doesn't it? So, why wouldn't you start a show called NCIS Sydney like that? It's what happens on the harbour every day.
Well, obviously the harbour bridge is always there and the opera house is always there. And I guess the water stuff that surrounds it's always there. And the military base is literally right next to the opera house. So, you know, all of that stuff's there. But that stereotypical hackneyed thing of politician addressing people from a podium, like, I knew they were going to go for it, and they absolutely delivered it. But
was it a press conference? Were they standing there with a reporter standing there with their pads and writing on their pads? Because that's always a good look for reporters.
Absolutely. I mean, a politician's not going to address sailors unless there's some sort of media scrum taking place at the same time. So fret not, that absolutely happens. But look, I know that when I posted the trailer for this through my newsletter, I got a whole bunch of responses back, and all the responses were incredibly sarcastic and just, you know, very demeaning. And this says to me two things. One, there was that. You did send me a message about it, but it tells me two things. It tells me, one, people are pretty interested at the idea of something called NCIS Sydney, okay? Because I don't get responses from every trailer that I talk about, okay? There's something about this one that catches the mood of the people. So they're onto something smart by doing an NCIS Sydney, I think. Okay. And then the other thing was just a whole bunch of people snidely talking about the number of shots of the Opera House and Sydney Harbour Bridge and all that sort of business. And all of that is fair criticism. Absolutely. But the thing to probably keep in mind with NCIS Sydney is that it's not necessarily for Australians to watch. Like, it is for Australians to watch, but there is a global audience in mind as well, and they're ticking a lot of boxes as they go through this.
Of course.
Yes. If they wanted something which was a NCIS series, which is a bit more sort of grounded, you know, why not do it in, you know, Perth? Like, why not? But you're doing it in Sydney because of the fact that that travels globally. So,
sure,
understandable, you know, it's all fine.
And not the first time American television has done this. Modern Family came here recently. There's Dennis Weaver came down here for his.
That stuff's all like different though. No, that stuff's all different because they just came here for an episode or two. This is a series that's of Australia. So even to the point where the guy that created the show is a guy named Morgan O'Neill. He's an Australian writer and actor. Okay, so it is of Australia. It's not like you got American writers coming through. That said, I can't help but feel that Morgan O'Neill maybe could have talked to some people that work within the Australian government and AFP and know that your lead cop wouldn't necessarily be taking directions from the foreign affairs minister. Like, that probably isn't necessarily the chain of command and how that works. That's maybe a script note that I'd give. But getting away from that, the whole premise of this one, it opens with you got a pair of cops who are AFP cops, both partners. Okay, and then you've got these two cops from NCIS, from America, who are in Sydney to solve the murder mystery of a sailor who ended up dying during that press conference I talked about at the front there. So this sailor falls over, falls into the water, and so this creates a bit of a issue for a number of reasons, because the guy's an American soldier, so therefore, you know, the Americans want to investigate it, but it happened in Australian waters, but it was off an American boat. You know, there's just a whole bunch of things. So it's not so much about who has the jurisdiction rights. Simon, stop talking. It's hard to listen to two people talking at the same time. That's how audio works. But anyway, you've got the issue where it's not so much who has the jurisdiction as much as the pissing contest over who feels that they should be the ones that are running it. So that's where the cops and the NCIS folk are engaged. They don't want each other's business getting in. Like, you've seen cop shows. You know how it works. The FBI come along and the local police don't want to deal with them. But when you're watching the FBI show, the FBI turn up and they don't like dealing with the local police. We've seen TV. We know how it works. So you've got that. But the wrinkle in this one is that in order to make NCIS Sydney work as a brand, somehow you permanently need these NCIS officers to be in Australia checking out, I guess, a murder that takes place every week within some sort of US naval capacity. Otherwise, the show does not work at all. So I don't know how far they can stretch this, but, you know, let's see how they do. They will have an ongoing arc that stretches through, because I'm not going to give any spoilers for the first episode, but there is a criminal who gets away who could be back sometime. Who knows? I guarantee they'll be back in the 10th episode, the season finale of this show. But because that's how TV works.
Is it any good?
But Simon, here's what you need to know. This is what people need to know. Okay. So is it any good? Very good question. We'll get to that right at the end. Okay. Is the show more NCIS or is it more Sydney? Strangely, the show is more Sydney than it is NCIS. What I think, and this may answer the question, is it any good? What I think makes this show actually work is that the general demeanor and the attitudes of the cops is very much actually kept in mind. So I used to work with this American guy named Nick Bassine. Simon, you know this guy.
Good friend. Lovely guy.
Very into working with him. He ended up just making some comment about the way that I view the world, which is that I'm a lot more relaxed and easygoing in the way that I approach like just day-to-day issues. That's he was true. Talking about it from an American perspective. But he was coming at it from an American perspective in which, you know, people may be a little bit more sort of wound up, a bit more, you know, rigid and focused about something. It doesn't quite have that sort of lethargic Australian nature that we do have about us. And not the Americans are traditionally well known as being like just super strict people. Like, you know, they're not Germans. Okay. But at the same time, there is that slight cultural difference. This show takes that into account. The Australian cops in it are very sort of laid back, and it's like, you know, a cop will come up and is like, I forget the NCIS guy's name, but he's like, you know, American man, NCIS. And so the other guy's like, oh, no, mate, just call me Dave. You know, it's that kind of thing. And so that is absolutely captured within the show in a really sort of nice, genuine way. The location shooting is all absolutely around Bondi Beach. It's all around the very picturesque harbour that surrounds near where the Opera House is within the like next 10 kilometer sort of radius around it. So in that first episode, at least, you will see some gorgeous, picturesque views of Sydney. Fantastic. Is it an NCIS program? It's absolutely NCIS. The jokes are all really dopey and just like just silly and just plays perfectly well for a, I'm just sitting on the couch, I just want to blob down and watch something. The murder mystery, not that interesting, okay? But again, NCIS, like the actual mystery element of it, it's not there to be solved. It's there for it just to wash over you at some point. This looks and feels like NCIS. What it doesn't do is the mistake that NCIS Hawaii made, which is that I watched NCIS Hawaii because I always watched the first episode of an NCIS and then realized I actually don't like NCIS programs very much and don't watch anymore. Okay. NCIS Hawaii in no way really felt like Hawaii at any point. In fact, you even get to the end of the first episode and they're standing out against a beach and I think it's a blue screen taking place. They're not actually at a beach. And that might have been a COVID thing. I don't quite remember when it started, but it didn't really feel authentic. NCIS New Orleans kind of did make a bit more of an overture to have like the jazz of New Orleans play a role in that first episode, at least.
The beat.
Okay, so I kind of always got there. I just didn't really like the show so much. Sydney feels like Sydney. And not even just, as I said, like they're around like that picturesque sort of coastal part. But there's one scene in it, and this will amuse people who have spent time in Sydney's inner west. But I don't think that culturally anyone knows about this outside of the inner west yet. There is a very specific pub that they've opened in just the last couple of years in Marrickville, which is called the John Hawke Leisure Centre. And it is a themed park around Bob Hawke. Okay, and it's not even just Bob Hawke. It's named after Bob Hawke, but it's themed around Australia in the 1980s. There's even a gimmick where if you go to the toilets, the music playing in the background isn't music. Instead, it is legitimate recordings of cricket games, okay, from the mid-80s that is playing. It's a really fun pub to visit. And at one seat, you haven't been there, Simon?
No, I've never been there. As a non-drinker, I don't go into pubs a lot, but this sounds like something I might pick up boozing again for.
Make an effort. You don't even need to go for a drink. Go in there for the 1980s era Chinese restaurant that they have within the pub. Okay. Like it is a gimmicky, silly, silly pub, but it's a lot of fun to pop in there for like an hour or two and, you know, throw back a yardie and see how you go.
A yardie?
But they visit the Bob Hawke Leisure Center.
Wow, this is amazing. Okay. All right. I digress.
The first episode. Yeah. Yeah. So look, essentially questions, because like I don't need to explain what this program is. Like everyone knows what this show is without seeing it. Like everyone knows what that opening scene was. But the questions are, is it NCIS? Yes. Is it Sydney? Surprisingly, very much yes. Is it incredibly glitzy and glamorous because they're trying to make it look as Sydney as possible? Yes. I'm hoping they get away from that. And I haven't had the chance to watch more than that first episode. So,
okay.
You know, just sort of take that for what it is. But so, I'm hoping that in the coming weeks, we see episodes that are maybe around like North Sydney, or they take things out to like a Western suburb and just play around some more sort of gritty sort of areas. I'd like to see that. Whether they'll do that or not, I'm not too sure. But so in this first episode, I will say I struggle with NCIS. I don't like NCIS very much, but I didn't mind this. I thought this was probably the most watchable of any of the NCIS programs. And part of it is the gimmickry of seeing that at Sydney, but also I didn't mind it. The cast are very, very appealing. Okay. William McInnes, my God, who would have ever thought that he's playing this role at this stage of his life? He has reached his Marlon Brando era of performance. Look, there's a lot to recommend about this program, but that said, top level idea, just keep this in mind. As much as I'm talking it up, it's still an NCIS program. Simon Foster.
So you've gone to some way to answering one of the main questions I have about NCIS Sydney, and is it palatable to Australian audiences? By which I mean, are there cutaways to Kangaroos? Are there cutaways to Crimson Rosellas? Are there things that are put in there to play up the Aussiness, the down-underness of it being shot in Sydney and being shot in Australia? Or is this a little bit smarter than that and you know, go some way to addressing the crime elements of it as much as the location? And I think you've answered that. It sounds like it kind of gets the balance okay.
Look, I mean, you don't see the wildlife because it's in a city, Sydney. So, like, that's just not really a case. But you'll see beaches. You'll see, like, the occasional person in a bikini going past, because that's pretty authentic to, like, that space. Like, that's all fine. And the one thing the show really has going for it is that there really actually is a naval base, like, right in the city, like, heart. And even not just the heart of the city, but when you get around to, like, the really nice... Well, when you get to like the really nice streets and suburbs, like over in that direction, like that's where the military base is. So it is authentic and legitimate. So, you know, take that for what it is.
NCIS Sydney is on Paramount Plus. Have they dropped the whole series, or are we going to go week by week?
It's going to go week to week. So starting next Friday, the 10th of November, you'll see this drop in Australia. 3 days later in the US on Monday night, you'll actually see it broadcast on CBS in the US. The plan was always for it to be available globally on Paramount Plus, but because there's the glut of no programs because of the strikes, they're putting it on the proper TV. So it's going to have a much bigger audience than you'd expect. It's going to have regular NCIS and NCIS Sydney back-to-back on broadcast TV in the US. And because it has that week-to-week rollout in the US, it's absolutely doing that in Australia as well.
That's very exciting. Good to see Aussie content, even if it's US-backed on American television. I guess they didn't bring out crews with this. It's all local crews as well, so plenty of people getting work from this. So that's a good thing as well. Thank you, Paramount Plus, and thank you, NCIS. Right, let's move on. Apple Films are presenting, as we speak, the global premiere of a little film called Fingernails.
All I needed was a love you gave.
Have you guys taken the test?
Yeah, 3 years ago, we were positive. Felt like a weight had been lifted.
I founded this institute to take the risk out of love. No more uncertainty, no more wondering if you've chosen the right partner, no more divorce. We were the first to build the machines to conduct the test to make the bond of love stronger.
This movie starts off with a very troubling quote. Apparently, you can tell if you have any kind of bad heart condition, or the first place you find out about this is on your fingernails. Now, I don't know if you can see this, but I have the ugliest fingernails in the world. I have been a fingernail biter for many years, so straight away. That's worth tuning into the YouTube channel for. I've been a fingernail biter for years. So this freaked me out right from the get-go, put me on the edge of my seat, which is not a bad place to be for fingernails. It is a very unusual film set, I'm not quite sure if it's set just in the future a little bit or in some kind of alternative modern reality. But in this world, you can test whether you love someone legitimately with a sense of truth by having your fingernails tested. There is a whole industry led by Luke Wilson, who runs this massive company, where they go through a whole series of tests with you, then remove ideally your pinky fingernail and test it in a machine with the person you love. And if it comes up 100%, you both love each other. If it comes up 50%, only one of you is in love. If it comes up 0%, you're not going to make it. And it takes as the basis this very odd society, this very sort of strange modern society as the basis for this terrific story of a woman called, played by Jessie Buckley, who is in a very... Sorry, Dan?
May I ask a question?
Yes, you may.
It can tell, like, with the percentage of how much you love a person, but can it distinguish whether you love them or love their money?
No, well, I assume the machine can. It is, you go through a series of quizzes and a series of tests and exercises to establish there is a genuine bond between, that you have a likeness for each other, that you have an affection for each other, and then you do the fingernail test to test whether it's a long-term true love. So it's a very romantic way of pulling each other's fingernails out. So that's sort of the weird headspace that this film works in. Jessie Buckley is in a long-term relationship.
I truly authentically love money, so I think I can pass the test.
Okay, you're probably good. She's in a long-term relationship with your man from The Bear, Jeremy Allen White. They've both passed the fingernail test. They're 100% results, so they're confident they're in love forever. But she gets a new job at the love testing facility, and she's working next to the very charming Riz Ahmed, who she begins to have some feelings for. This movie sort of really leans into a very cinematic take on what romance is. Everyone's been influenced by films and books and television. At one point, they're seen attending a Hugh Grant romantic film festival, which is a cute sort of shot at his place in the world of romance films. But then it sort of takes kind of a dark turn. It's got a bit of a 70s feel about it, this film. It played at the Toronto Film Festival recently to kind of mixed reviews, which I can sort of see why, because it's a far out kind of premise, and it doesn't quite nail the landing in the way that something like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind did, which was also a strange kind of alternate reality, technology influencing love type of storyline. But it's such a unique way of telling a story that I was kind of hooked. And, of course, anything Jessie Buckley is okay by me. So it's a film that may or may not entirely win you over, but it is one of the most unique films I've seen in a long, long time, one of the more clever original ideas to make it to the big screen. It's playing in a few cinemas literally on the same day that it dropped on Apple TV. So if you've got Apple TV, you can watch it at home, and it's fine on the small screen, I think. But to see these three really good actors do their thing, it's probably worth having a look. It's called Fingernails on Apple TV and in limited release.
Okay, fantastic. Well, I will definitely give that one a gander because I like everyone involved in that one.
Yeah, good cast.
Simon, I'm going to move on. I'm going to talk about lawman Bass Reeves.
You a lawman or an outlaw?
Bit of both, I reckon. I need a man with a good gun and a straight spine. You up for the task? I wouldn't be sitting here my Sunday best if it wasn't.
So look, much like NCIS Sydney, actually this has quite a fair bit in common with NCIS Sydney in that it's a brand extension. It is a Paramount Plus series. And also, I kind of feel that before you press play on it, you kind of already know what the program is. So look, Bass Reeves was a real life guy. If people, read your history books, people, but from a pop cultural standpoint, if people remember, from a pop culture standpoint, Simon, because I know that you've seen things, If you ever watched the beginning of Watchmen, the TV series on HBO a couple of years ago, it opens with a extended sequence where they talk about Bass Reeves and him as a lawman, as an African-American man, sort of inspiring and, you know, being a leading light for law enforcement, or men of color in law enforcement.
Good.
So anyway, this is based on a real guy. His name's Bass Reeves. Reeves was the surname of his slave owner, who you see in the first episode of this one, played by Shea Whigham. Anytime that you got Shea Whigham on screen, I'm absolutely up for it. Anyway, he's great. He's got really good chemistry with, and gosh, I'm going to struggle as I try to say his name for the first time. David Ayelowo.
Nice.
Ayelowo. Oh, God, no.
Ayelowo, I think it's pronounced.
Ayelowo. Okay. Yeah. You know, culturally, we should be with David by this point, but we're just not. But anyway, he plays the titular Bass Reeves, and this is what the series is. It's about a guy who was a slave. He's a person who's a very impressive person generally. Like, it opens with him in a, we'll say, a fight sequence of sorts. There's like some guns a-blazing, and people are marveling at his skill there. So you've got this guy, super impressive, and obviously he ends up sort of finding freedom to a certain degree, and that's kind of what this first episode is about for the program. The problem is that we've seen, so the show, it's not strictly a Yellowstone spinoff, okay, or really a spinoff from, I guess, 1883 being the Western set Yellowstone prequel series. It's not quite a spinoff, but despite the fact that this involves a real life person at the heart of it, they've still placed the series within the Yellowstone universe. So it still exists as an adjunct to the Yellowstone stuff. Okay, the problem with that is that the look and feel of it is very familiar looking. And as we're now, four different Yellowstone series deep, with a few more on the horizon, like, we kind of know what a Yellowstone look and feel looks like. And that's maybe to the detriment of this show, which isn't really allowed to be its own thing. It just kind of still needs to adhere to like a certain sort of visual presentation style. And so with that in mind, watching this, it's as good as the cast is, and there's some really fun people that crop up through there. Dennis Quaid's in there, John Sutherland, Donald Sutherland's in there. Like, you know, there's proper names in this, much in the same way that all these Yellowstone programs always have a couple of fairly big marquee names playing supporting roles through them. The problem is that as much as there's the opportunity to do some really sort of wild, interesting things, it still kind of feels like it's adhering to just this visual template. And that kind of lets it down. And that's a bit of a shame, because I think David Ayelowo is incredibly charismatic in the lead. He's very watchable. You want to follow him through for what I think is going to be a limited series of 10 episodes. Like, you're very much there for that. But at the same time, there's just something that you can't get past, which is that we've seen this before. And that's maybe unfair, but it kind of is what it is.
How deep can we go into the Yellowstone-iverse going forward? There just seems to be this endless sort of back catalogue or forward catalogue of characters that seem endlessly easy to dramatise or can be worked into a series format.
Well, look, all of the, because they keep calling it the Dutton-verse, because it's the Dutton family that you're kind of following through most of these. Yep. But we'll call it the Yellowstone-iverse because, you know, why not?
Queensland was the Dutton-verse.
You know, aspirationally.
Okay.
Yeah. So I would maybe say, let's not sort of think about how much you can mine Yellowstone for, because all it's really doing is just telling stories from a rural American perspective. Like, it's all very much lots of people in cowboy hats and what they get up to. What I think maybe to keep in mind is that in the 50s and 60s, most TV shows on American TV, most dramas, were all Westerns. And I'm here criticizing Lawman Bass Reeves. And I'm sure after Lawman Bass Reeves, they'll extend the Lawman franchise to become its own thing within the Yellowstone sort of world. I'm expecting Lawman Simon Foster, like 15 seasons from now when I've run out of ideas.
No way, I'm a rebel.
Yeah, sure. That's the sort of thing that gets you a TV series made about you. But this is the thing. So we're going to see that sort of continue on, and we're going to see more and more Westerns with a very similar look and feel. But this isn't anything new, because TV used to be dominated by TV programs like this. And I have frequently argued that American TV needs to be talking to this rural audience quite a bit more and bringing stories from the West and other pockets from throughout America and actually put them on TV. This is doing that, and it just kind of feels like it's a bit samey, but only because so few other networks and streamers and producers are producing anything with that regular sort of churn of content. Back in the day, this was a standard thing that you find on TV, and these days it kind of feels a bit standard, and that's maybe a shame, because the show is better than just being considered as being a bit standard.
So is this a big three network TV show that's going to hit the flyover states, or is it one of the streamers?
Well, I've already said this, Simon, like twice. It's Paramount Plus.
Oh, Paramount Plus. Okay, but in the US. Okay, so it's gone out through. So it may not have the audience that Yellowstone had, which was immense.
Well, Yellowstone's audience is massive because it talks to a much older audience, and it's on a cable network station, which is accessible to people. So the audience reach for that's much bigger. But also, they've just started playing old episodes of that on CBS because they've got this drought of TV programs, and it is rating socks off because it's finding yet another audience that haven't seen this program yet. So look, Lawman Bass Reeves, there's no content in it that feels particularly un-network. There's a sex scene pretty early into the first episode, and it's very broadcast network safe. There's nothing that they're doing which is too overt or gross or adult.
Lawman Bass Reeves, in case you didn't hear, is on Paramount Plus. It looks interesting. I'm going to have a look at it. I'm a big fan of David Oyelowo. So, now, I got along and hung out with the kids at the big blockbuster film at the moment, Freddy's Five Nights. I almost said Freddy Got Fingered. That was a while back. Five Nights at Freddy's.
Just keep your eyes on the monitor.
Welcome to Freddy Fazbear's, where fantasy and fun come to life.
Okay.
You must be new security guard.
Can I help you, officer?
Have you met them yet?
Met who?
Them.
Were you a fan of Freddy Got Fingered, the Tom Green movie? I thought that was hilarious at the time, but it got some terrible reviews.
Oh, look, I'm a fan of sausage fingers across the globe, regardless if they're Freddy's or otherwise.
All right, so tell me, did you play the game as a younger man? I understand it came on the scene, and I didn't do my research here, but I was told about 2014, had a huge following, has a huge following. Were you a Five Nights at Freddy's fan? A lot of Fs.
Look, I mean, you keep talking about this being a younger man. Like, I was in my early to mid-30s. But no, I didn't play this game. But here's the thing, Simon, and you said this earlier, and you were surprised at the box office for this. This is the exact same thing as earlier in this year where we had the box office for Super Mario. And I remember saying on this here very podcast, at no point was I surprised at the box office success of the Super Mario animated film. Okay, and the same thing with Five Nights at Freddy's. Like, this was a huge property that has been a pop cultural phenomenon, but for people who haven't been paying attention to games in the way they probably need to be paid attention to, it's cultural ephemera, which just hasn't been noticed. This is a very big title, and I was really surprised at how many box office prognosticators didn't see this one coming.
Well, I'm not surprised in that it's horror, which is, it'll be, the skill of its marketing and its release strategy will be in its second week to see what the drop-off is. It was released at Halloween, so it became the Halloween horror film to see. You're right, it's got a huge following and a legacy following as a game title, so that's a big plus. There were some articles, in fact, I read one article that said $80 million at the box office, you'd be happy with if that was the end of this film's box office run. It was budgeted at maybe $15 million, I think, from memory. So to come out of the gates with an $80 million US opening is pretty extraordinary. It was very cleverly marketed, and it was very cleverly produced by the Blumhouse people. It takes the game and the key characters in the game and spins it off into this supernatural dream sort of reality that made it a very Blumhouse kind of title. The occurrences that happen in the film happen are largely set inside a dream state, the key character's dream state. And I should point out Josh Hutcherson, who I've not given any sort of sideways glances to even during his Hunger Games co-starring period. He's really good in the lead of this. He plays it dark and he plays it fairly straight, and the drama is certainly there in his performance. So I think a lot can be my sort of emotional involvement in the film can be credited to his performance. I did say in a post during the week that there's almost too much story in this. A lot of people are comparing it to Nicolas Cage's Willy's Wonderland, which was a straight up janitor versus crazy robots that come alive sort of bit of nonsense. One of my lesser Nicolas Cage films, although it's developed a bit of a following. This one goes almost the other way. It creates a whole backstory involving ghost kids and Josh Hutcherson's little sister and a cop who's involved with what might be the bad guy. And that made it feel like a legitimately fleshed out horror film. So while it's not going to feature very heavily come Oscar time or the award season in general, Five Nights at Freddy's is actually a pretty good watch. And the fact that it picked up momentum at the box office after its opening sort of midweek run and sort of found a lot of favor on the Saturday and Sunday sessions, I think that's because people go, hey, it's actually a much better film than it might have been otherwise. So, yeah, I thought Five Nights at Freddy was pretty good, and I'm keen to see if it sort of goes to the giant box office heights that some are predicting it will.
Yeah, look, I'm pretty keen to check this out at some point.
I should point out that I did watch it. I did not see it at the movies. I watched it on the a certain streaming platform to which I have access. That, I mean, they're the incredible figures. It had a blockbuster release at the movies, but it also had a blockbuster streaming release in the US on the Peacock network. So that's another box office, or that's another sort of entertainment record that it's broken, that it's doing those sort of numbers in both cinemas and on the small screen at home.
Yeah, look, that probably says a lot more about the audience for Peacock than it does for necessarily the film release. Peacock, not the most successful of streamers, Simon.
But big numbers, nevertheless. It's hard to deny that the record numbers that have come from that. I don't know what that means in terms of people signing up to Peacock to watch it, but I guess that proof will be in the pud.
People don't know what a peacock is.
It's a very noisy bird. I stayed at an Airbnb once that boasted they had peacocks walking around the venue, and they were so noisy and so horrible early in the morning. But hey, that's fun. Anyway, here we are.
Okay, Simon, enough about peacocks. Let's go straight to our intermission.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's intermission time.
The Variety newspaper this week, there was a major front page story called Crisis at Marvel. Now, this is sort of, and I'm going to read the first couple of paragraphs. I've paraphrased them a bit, so I've shrunk it down. But it gave us an idea about this, our midsection this week, our intermission. This past September, a group of Marvel creatives, including studio chief Kevin Feige, is that how you say it, Kevin Feige? Assembled in Palm Springs for the studios and for the studio's annual retreat. Now, most years the vibe would have been confident, even cocky, given how the premier superhero brand owned by Disney since 2009 has remade the entertainment business in its image. But this occasion was angst-ridden. Everyone at Marvel was reeling from a series of disappointments on screen, a legal scandal involving one of its biggest stars, and questions about the viability of the studio's ambitious strategy to extend the brand beyond movies into streaming. So Marvel is in a bit of a state right now. We'll get onto the details of what those opening sentences mean, but we thought we'd have a look at what's wrong with Marvel and perhaps how can we fix Marvel? What can Dan and Simon bring to the table that will save the entertainment giant from a pretty steep decline in revenue and popularity? Dan Barrett, you lead off.
So, sorry, I'm literally just distracted by the fact that I quite literally just discovered that the Brisbane International Film Festival has been running for over a week now. And despite the fact that I am regularly around the Brisbane area, at no point did I realize this was even happening. And I've just missed screenings for Shortcomings and Saltburn and a whole bunch of other films that I would have liked to have gotten to see. But anyway, sorry, Focus this is a Dan. Minor distraction that I've just been done. Dan. Sorry, what's the actual question? What's the actual question you've thrown at me here?
How do we fix Marvel? We've got Jonathan Majors. How do we fix? Okay. Very nasty legal battle.
Okay, here we go. I know the premise. I just know exactly what you asked me. Okay, how do we fix it? I think the solution to fixing Marvel is very, very simple, okay, but hasn't been done. The problem with Marvel isn't superhero fatigue. The problem is that all of it just feels and looks exactly the same. There is a house style for the visual quality of it. This is the same problem I was just leveling at Yellowstone just a minute ago. There's a very similar house style to how it's filmed. There's a similar budget level that's been given to everything. And those budgets keep on increasing, but it's not necessarily evident on screen. And part of that is because of that house style. Okay. It's not particularly the sort of forward plan, but also I think the biggest concern for them is they haven't learned enough from the TV show 24. So, I mean, I thought it was obvious they hadn't learned from 24. Anyone else?
What are you talking about?
So 24, the premise of that show is that it is a season-long program over 24 episodes, okay, where you can follow the story from first episode through to the end. But when you watch that program, you're not actually following the same story through. You see what you think is the story, and then you follow that for about two episodes, and then it becomes something else. And every two episodes of that is another short contained story, which kind of equal up to a larger story. But even that, it's not like it's then suddenly 12 stories that equal up, but really the show always pivots every like 4 to 5 episodes and goes in an entirely different direction. The villain that you think is going to be the villain from those first couple of episodes never turns out to be the villain. Instead, it's a character that's introduced in like episode 13 or 14 that suddenly takes greater prominence because they've made storytelling changes or whatever, but it's not a consistently large scale story. It's lots of small little stories. Marvel is trying to do this large canvas storytelling, but they're not really paying attention to where the smaller stories are and keeping audiences engaged. And part of the problem leveled at Marvel is your average casual viewer. Simon, you've made this complaint before. Lots of people will say this, saying, oh, I don't want to have to watch this movie because I don't want to have to like do homework. It all feels like homework that I need to watch these small stories to be able to catch up with the big one. If you missed an episode of 24, you don't feel as though you can't catch up because all the information is right there. And you know that even if you're confused for 15 minutes or an episode or two, it's just going to pivot again very shortly and you're caught up entirely. You don't feel that you've really missed a beat. Marvel needs to embrace that more. It needs to be shorter runs, like not 7 or 8 films consist of like a phase of Marvel films. It should be every 2 to 3 films require a phase. But then also I'm talking about this sort of sameness going through. If you look at the early batch of Marvel films, when it was at its most successful, what did you have? You had Iron Man. Iron Man is a, he's not quite a street level character, but it's kind of an action adventure show about a wealthy guy with a rocket pack. Okay. And then what else do you have? You had Thor, which is a mystical god storyline. So that's an entirely different flavor coming through again. You had Captain America, which is very much a street level type of hero. It's a World War II story of a guy out there with a shield just smashing Nazis. What else did we have in that first lot there, Simon? I'm missing somebody.
The Hulk.
There was an Incredible Hulk. Yeah. And again, that kind of feels a bit different, but like all of them are tonally just a bit different. But you watch the current crop of films and it all kind of feels as though there's a very strong, like cosmic universe, galaxy spanning thing. It's a one flavor, like there's no consistency. And they're all pegged at that same budget, the same sort of level of special effects taking place. What you need to do is what they're apparently doing with the upcoming Marvel film Blade. They're shrinking the budget right down. It's going to be a dirty, grimy little vampire superhero movie. Do that, yeah. Then give us some big budget stuff, and then give us like a mid-tier thing. Just shake it up. Think about 24. Think about how they were able to pivot and change storylines with regularity and just move things all over the place while still giving you enough to make it think it's a big part of a large story. But it's about those little choices along the way. It needs to be little. It needs to be small. It needs to be big. It needs to just have variation. That's how you fix Marvel. You shake things up and you don't have to let it feel the same.
All right. I think for a casual viewer of Marvel like me, I think one of the main problems is they front-loaded their first decade of box office dominance with all their big characters. There was all those that you just rattled off, and now they're expecting the same sort of box office returns and audience interest in characters like Ant-Man or She-Hulk or Moon Knight or any of those characters. They're putting methodology and they're putting measurements against these smaller characters and then judging them as failures when they don't hit that golden sort of $500 million box office or whatever the equivalent streaming numbers are. So I think that's an issue. They're literally running out of interesting people to talk about or interesting ways of telling
Simon, slight sort of counterpoint to that. They haven't run out of the big characters. Instead, they're just not focusing on some of the bigger characters they've got. Okay, so
they're running out of characters
you're
to
right,
get people
but,
like me to go along. Yeah.
No, they haven't run out of the characters. They're just not using them yet is part of the problem. So they've used some of their big marquee characters right up, but they still have X-Men. They've still got Fantastic Four, but they're taking their time getting to them, and that's a problem. Instead, it's Ms. Marvel. It's what was that? I'm trying to think of that name. The superhero film directed by Chloe Zhao. What is this? The Inhumans.
Eternals,
sorry. Yeah. Like, it's stuff like that. Like, they're just not really going to what they could. Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's fan element there that brought the Eternals undone as well. The other issue that the variety story points out is that the part of the big problem at the moment is, and it's led to the unionization of the Marvel effects units and Marvel effects team, is because that the schedule they put them under is too huge. The amount of content they're trying to sort of push out is ridiculously scheduled. And the look and feel of the film, and you and so many others have pointed out about Ant-Man, was that the special effects look crummy, that the standard by which they made films like the Avengers movies and the original Iron Man and some of their great films has long since departed, and that Kevin Feige, who was the barometer by which great special effects and the quality of the quality control of the company has let it slip terribly. The woman whose name I can't remember, who was mentioned in the story, who was sacked, she was the head of the VFX division. She looks like a bit of a scapegoat now. So there's that element within the company that I think is a problem. The other element that's raised in the story is, and this is not so much of Marvel's doing, but what they're going to do with the Jonathan Majors problem. He, as Kang the Ant-Man film, he's going to push right into the next phase of the Marvel Avengers-style universe, and he's may not have a career past the end of, past middle of next year.
Sorry, Simon.
All the court cases play out.
Simon, we all know what the problems are, but what are you doing to fix it? This is what we're here for. What's Simon Foster doing to fix the Marvel problems?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a great question. What do you do to fix when your main star that you've invested millions of dollars in and the character that's meant to lead the next phase of your revenue stream going forward is toxic? I don't know. That's
yeah, but what are you doing?
I don't know what to do in that case, but that's what's facing.
No, but this entire segment,
I don't think following the template set by 24 is going to fix their problems. I think that's an issue that the other thing that allowed 24 to work in that regard and pivot for smaller characters and smaller villains within the confines of that story can't be applied to a superhero universe, because fans are watching where these stories go and where those pivots take them and how they treat legacy characters. This is a challenging situation. They've got to try variations within a format that doesn't allow for variations very much.
Simon, the premise of this segment is, what are we doing to fix it? What's your proposal?
Uh, Jonathan Majors' character will have to be either CGI'd out of these films, and it's not without precedent. Who was the character actor who was in the early Iron Man films who was replaced by Don Cheadle? I can't remember his name now, but
it's Terrence Howard.
Terrence Howard, yes, it's not without precedent that the that can happen within the MCU, and the whole sort of multiverse get out of jail free card that happens within comic book films could change that up without a problem. So maybe that's what they do to solve the Jonathan Majors story.
Jonathan Majors isn't the biggest problem Marvel has. Jonathan Majors is a problem for Marvel.
Yeah.
Okay, but like, there's no reason why you can't just introduce another villain and just pivot away. The problem Marvel has, the problem that they've got is that the storytelling engine just isn't particularly that strong, and they haven't really thought about how to continually feed that beast. So if we want to keep things within like a Marvel context, there's a thing that they started doing in the like early 2000s where they gave the X-Men all the same sort of uniform and just tried to sort of keep it look really sort of tight and consistent. The problem with that, though, is that that gets boring really, really quickly. And Marvel have kept it feeling tight and consistent all the way through, but they've never really sort of allowed for any variance to take place. And this is what I'm talking about in terms of using a 24-style structure, or in terms of shifting around sort of budget levels and types of movies you're releasing. People don't actually want consistency after a while. People want things feeling a bit different and a bit more unique. And to me, this is the problem with Marvel. This is where it needs to be fixed. And maybe the Jonathan Majors situation provides an opportunity for them, which is to pivot. Like, maybe Kang wasn't the villain after all. Maybe it's really heading to something else.
I think that's going to have to happen. I definitely think that's on the cards. I would also suggest that what you hinted at there is very, very true. Sometimes genres run their course. Sometimes the MCU or the DC universe, and I think DC faces this because I don't know if everyone's going to jump over to a James Gunn-inspired DC universe going forward, but I think maybe just a certain style of film has run its course. There's been those, and I don't agree with this entirely, but there are those that say, hey, you said yourself, once upon a time, Westerns ruled the airwaves, and once upon a time, sci-fi epics ruled the airwaves. Now it's comic book movies, and maybe those audiences that were of a certain age when Iron Man came out, their kids are now looking at these films and saying, oh, they're not so cool. They're kind of stupid. They're men in capes and tights. We don't want to watch this anymore. Maybe just the old style, and by old, I mean 2000 and early 2000s comic book movie, is just in its death throes.
So I don't think it is. And I think the difference between Westerns and today is that if you look at a TV broadcast from 1963 to 1973, the only thing that's really changed there is that, yes, the cameras are a little bit better and whatnot, but the general experience of watching TV wasn't all that different. So shifting from cowboy shows to cop shows, which, I mean, realistically, take the hats off them and give them more of a cityscape, and are kind of the same programs anyway. But that's not that much of a big sort of tonal shift. But what I think is probably different about the modern age of cinema is that we've lent so much more into big tentpole movies. And in order to be able to keep things at a scale which gives people a reason to go to a cinema and not just play a video game at home, or to watch a high-budget TV program or whatever, like, scale has become such an important part of that Hollywood experience. So in order to actually do that, you need stories that can meet that scale. And I don't think that superhero is necessarily the only genre to do it, but also I struggle to think of that many stories that can provide cinema experiences at that level of scale that don't involve superhuman people doing something. I appreciate that a superhuman person isn't necessarily the same thing genre-wise as superheroes. They can be two separate types of things, but I think that it's a bit limited in terms of what your possibilities are. So while movies need to keep playing at the scale, I think you're going to see superheroes as being a dominant medium because very few other things can feed that.
I am enthused to see how the comic book genre is able to resurrect itself and find a way forward after the last 8 to 12 months, which have involved high-profile duds like Black Adam, The Flash, the tracking on the Marvels, the troubles with Aquaman 2, the waning TV audiences for the MCU channel, MCU shows on the Disney Plus and Disney around the world. So I can't recall a time in all my history of watching movies when what was assured blockbusters going forward and positive buzz around comic book movies has all but dissipated.
Yes.
You agree? You're good. You agree. Okay. That's
fine. Oh, look. No, I mean, so sorry, am I agreeing to the idea that you're interested? Like, you know, that's not really quite an agreement. Look, I mean, I think that there have been massive creative problems at Marvel, and it's echoed the creative problems that DC have had for quite a few years at this point. I'm not that interested to see sort of how they're going to do it, because I think it's quite clear how they can do it. It's just, I guess the question I'd be interested in is the political control that various people have within Disney necessarily going to be strong enough to have a major creative pivot anytime soon? And that's probably what I'm more interested in. If I was running Disney, and this is going to be leading to a much bigger question, one of the things I'd probably be inclined to do is take Kevin Feige entirely away from Marvel, put some new blood into that, and take Kevin Feige over to Star Wars and let him have at it. He's more of a Star Wars guy than he is a Marvel guy. And, you know, he will have said that for years. Put him in charge there. Kathleen Kennedy's done a terrible job with Star Wars the last couple of years. Yes, Andor managed to happen, but, you know, that's a, you know, miracle, frankly, compared to the way that most of the stuff's been handled there. Get rid of her, bring in Feige, find somebody else to be running Marvel at this point, graduate from within and give things a bit of a fresh blood.
Okay, I'll wait and see. There we go. We've solved all of Marvel's problems, a little bit of Star Wars, a little bit of DC too. Going. The industry must just lie awake at night thanking their stars that you and I run this podcast. I tell you what.
No, not happy birthday. No, not that. Please, no. Not happy birthday.
Can you name, there's something about the title of all these stars' films that binds them together. November 8, 1975, Tara Reid. November 8, 1968, Parker Posey. November 10, 1999, Kiernan Shipka. And November 10, 1977, the lovely Brittany Murphy, God bless her. Can you think of anything that might tie all these girls together?
So the only thing that I could really come up with was proximity to Pussycats. And I feel that's not the answer.
Oh, I see. So you're Kiernan Shipka with her her Sabrina thing with the cat, yes?
Kiernan Shipka was in the Archie series, so she was Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, which then, was that even the name of the show? Whatever they called it. Yeah. You know, that character existed within the Riverdale shows where Josie and the Pussycats were characters. Tara Reid was very much in Josie and the Pussycats. Also in Josie and the Pussycats was Parker Posey.
You're good.
And then, sorry, who was the fourth person?
Brittany Murphy.
It was the fourth person. It was Brittany Murphy. Brittany Murphy ended up recording a single. Sorry, I did some research on this, trying to work out what the Brittany Murphy Pussycats thing would be. But wow. She released a single that was based on the Russ Meyer film, Kill Pussycat Kill. I can't think of the name of the song now. But,
Barrett,
yeah, that's her Pussycat connection. But I feel that's not what you're after.
In coming up with a very good answer, albeit a very wrong answer, that was a lot of research you did. Well done, sir. No, this was all to do with the titles of their films.
Well, actually, it wasn't a lot of research. I researched one of them. I got the other three.
And then it just leads, one thing leads to another. That's very true. They have all made films with girl in the title. It's that simple. Tara Reid starred in a 1988 teen romance just called Girl with Dominique Swain and Sean Patrick Flannery, which sounds so 90s. Parker Posey, of course, made a name for herself as the indie sort of indie film darling, 90s indie film darling with Party Girl. Kiernan Shipka One of her early hits was a starring role in the streaming film Fangirl, which also featured the wonderful Beanie Feldstein. And Brittany Murphy, well, she made a lot of girl movies. She did Ramen Girl, Girl Interrupted, Uptown Girl, and quite ironically and rather sadly, one of her final films was called The Dead Girl. So it was just that they all had girl in the title. I'm going to go with your answer, though. It was much better.
Well, I was going to say, like, you heard my answer, and yet you pretended that there was another answer.
This week in history, November 5, you're messing up with the order hits, messing with my head. I love it. Shaking things up. See, this was your MCU thing. November 5, 1953, which Marilyn Monroe musical is the first film to be shot in the ultra-widescreen cinemascope format?
Not a clue. I'm just going to say Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
Oh, I don't think that's the answer. How to Marry a Millionaire, although its release was delayed so that the biblical epic The Robe could be the public debut of CinemaScope, but How to Marry a Millionaire was actually shot first. In 2018, on November 6th, which British actor is named People Magazine's Sexiest Man Alive? Boom, cheeky.
Unimpressed. No, that's not the fair word. Confused by your little dance there. Look, I don't know. I'm just going to say, don't know. Who is it?
It was Dennis Waterman. No, wait a minute. That's a mistake there. It was Idris Elba was named People Magazine's Sexiest Man Alive for 2018. And then one day later, November 9, 2018, what got an appearance by K-pop boy band BTS on Japanese television cancelled at the last minute? Why would you cancel K-pop boy band BTS on Japanese television at the last minute?
Was there some sort of a nuclear missile incident taking place around then?
Oh, you've gone the right path. You're very good at deduction. One of the members of the band wore a T-shirt with an atomic bomb mushroom cloud on it, which is not the thing to do in Japan. And that got them cancelled off a TV show. So how about that?
This is the end of the show, Simon. Folks, thank you very much for listening or watching if you're on YouTube or Spotify. Folks, if you want to get more of me, and frankly, who wouldn't, check out the Always Be Watching newsletter. You can find that one 5 days a week at alwaysbewatching.com, but sign up and it just lands in your inbox. How good's that? Each day you get the latest stories in TV, streaming, and film, anything on a screen I usually talk about in that newsletter. Simon Foster, where can people find you?
Well, I'm starting to put a bit more work into screen-space.net, so you can see some new stuff there. All our screen-watching socials are up and running at the moment, at Screen-Watching Podcast on the Facebook, X at screen_watching. Gee, some of the figures about how X has fallen off the map are worrying. Well, not really worrying. YouTube is at screen-watching, and our email is screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com.
Okay, well, guys, this is the end of the podcast. We'll be back next week. There's some really big titles coming up TV-wise over the next month, so should be an exciting couple of weeks ahead. Anyway, folks, this has been Screen Watching. Thank you very much. We'll be back next week.